is 1:08 p.m. We have here with us Representative Sponholz, Representative Rauscher, Representative Reinbold, Representative Parrish, Representative Sadler, and myself, Vice Chair Ledoux. We have before us here a presentation today about the history of the United States Coast Guard. And I'm very sorry, sir, but I just subbed in here right now, and I'm not sure what your name is.
Gene White.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. White. Can you put yourself on the record, tell us who you represent, and you can proceed with your history of the Coast Guard.
All right. Thank you very much. My name is Gene White. I am here representing myself. I have a long-standing interest in the history of Alaska and the Coast Guard, and it basically came together in this presentation. So with that, I think I'll get started. And thank you for the committee for having me here. I did spend 4 years in the Coast Guard a really long time ago. Okay, I'm going to, like with any good, start out with a little small review and a quiz. This is a uniform services overview, and I'm going to ask some rhetorical questions here. So how many branches comprise the military? Yes, the correct answer is five. And here's the logos of the five branches: Army, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard. Okay. Bonus mic here. How many total uniform services are there, including military and non-military? Now remember, these are rhetorical questions, but anybody wants to jump in. So the hint is more than five in the last slide. And the answer is seven. Now, a lot of times, since I've been in the Coast Guard, there's always a lot of misunderstanding about what uniformed services are, how the Coast Guard fits in, et cetera. So briefly, I've put number six down as the national, on the last slide, the seven, and this is the title in the U.S. Code that actually defines NOAA and the U.S. Public Health Service as uniformed services. And I got to go back. NOAA and the Public Health Service. Okay, first NOAA. NOAA has been around a long time, since 1807. Originally started out as the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey.
Can we take a brief at ease?
Please continue on, Mr. White.
Thank you. NOAA is the oldest, its predecessor is the oldest scientific agency in the United States. It was started in 1807, was the Coast and Geodetic Survey. They did a lot of the mapping for the navigation around the coastlines and stuff. The NOAA uniform, NOAA has commissioned officers. That's why they're one of the seven uniformed services, and their uniforms are Navy uniforms with NOAA insignia. Next is the Public Health Service. Public Health Service originates all the way back to 1798. There was an act that created Marine hospitals to help sick and disabled seamen. The Public Health Service also wears Navy uniforms with. And some of you are familiar with the uniforms because, as you see, the Surgeon General is an admiral in the service as a commissioned officer. In the CDC, they wear, all the commissioned officers are in CDC, and we know them here in Alaska also in the Native Health Service, Native Hospital in Anchorage. You'll see uniforms. So there's those are the seven uniformed services. Okay, I've got a picture of Senator Lisa Murkowski. Seems a little odd to have her picture, but there's a reason for that. Lisa Murkowski was born in Ketchikan in a And the reason that she was born is because her dad was in the Coast Guard. Now, traditionally, the Coast Guard is the only military branch that doesn't have essentially doctors or hospitals. So traditionally, the Coast Guard's always used the service. And as in the course of these presentations, I actually ran into a public health service dentist whose wife was a nurse who delivered Lisa Murkowski in Ketchikan.
Real quick, some questions, Representative Ledoux and Representative Sadler.
So I used to live in Kodiak, which I believe has the biggest Coast Guard base in the country. Kodiak has its own Coast Guard hospital, doesn't it? Or is that a public health service hospital that I always thought was the Coast Guard hospital?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. Typically, the Coast Guard does have clinics around, I know, but I'm not actually sure the answer to the question.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. White, I appreciate your trivia question, so I'll throw one back at you. Lisa's father, what was his rating in the Coast Guard?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't really know. I've never heard him talk about it, and I don't know what his rating was.
Storekeeper second.
Oh, he's a storekeeper. All right. Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, thank you. So what is it that defines the Coast Guard as military? Because like I said previously, a lot of times I've gotten questions. A lot of people don't quite understand how the Coast Guard fits in. And it's basically understandable. But in the United States Code under Title 14, the Coast Guard was established January 28, 1915, shall be a military service in the branch of the armed forces of the United States at all times. Further down in that same title, subsection 89, the Coast Guard is tasked with law enforcement, so the Coast Guard enforces maritime law of the United States. So in 1915, the Coast Guard was officially became a military service, even though before that it had been acting basically as a military service anyway, but it became official in 1915 by merging the Revenue Cutter Service and the Life-Saving Service to combine to form the Coast Guard with the emblem we know today. Go into a brief Coast Guard history. This is a slide that makes typically Coasties very happy because the Navy was disbanded in 1785. In the beginning, this person was the father of the Coast Guard. He's on the $10 bill. He's the first Secretary of the Treasury, and his name was Alexander Hamilton. So he, because we'd been in the Revolutionary War, we were basically essentially a broke country. We had no money, and we didn't have that many ways to collect revenue. So one of the things that we had done is we had customs laws with the attendant duties and tariffs. And so Alexander Hamilton decided to develop a system of cutters to help enforce the tariff laws and assist in the collection of the monies. And so there was formed the first it was basically the Revenue Marine and then later known as the Revenue Cutter Service. And that, of course, was 4 August 1790. And just as a reference, the Constitution was ratified in 1788, so the Revenue Cutter Service came into existence only 2 years after the Constitution was ratified. Revenue Cutter Service was charged with enforcing custom laws. Then in 1822, a few points here, the Timber Act was passed to protect the country's strategic natural resources, and the Revenue Cutter Service was playing a big role in this. And then a little further down the line, in 1912, the Titanic sank, and the International Ice Patrol was formed, which the Revenue Cutter Service was a large part of. In 1791, the first ship was actually commissioned, the first of 10 of these cutters. It looks like a fairly decent sized ship, but everything was smaller back then, and this ship, we'll call it a ship for the purposes of discussion, is only 48 feet long. It's a two-master. Then we'd gone along for several years without a Navy, and so the Congress finally decided in 1794 that, gosh, maybe we needed a Navy after all. So in 1794, an act was passed to basically recreate the Navy, but however, it didn't come operation until 1798. So the Coast Guard or Revenue Cutter Service was active in all wars. In fact, in the very first real war we had after the we'll call it a war, it's a very interesting affair. It's known as the XYZ affair. But this happened in 1797. The Navy wasn't operational yet, so the Revenue Cutter Service was actually the only Marine force we had, and they, in fact, were enforcing. And it was a war with the French, and it was essentially the Revenue Cutter Service was protecting us from the problems we're having with the privateers. And moving along, just a short list of the wars here. War of 1812, the Seminole Wars, Mexican War, Civil War, Spanish-American War, World Wars I and II, Korea conflict, Vietnam, Gulf War, Middle East, and everything ever since. And all these wars, the Revenue Cutter Service of the Coast Guard has played an important part. War of 1812, Revenue Cutter captured the British schooner, naval capture of that conflict. Civil War. On the left is the steamer Nashville. This is at the very start of the Civil War. On the right is the Revenue Cutter Harriet Lane. The Nashville was trying to steam into Charleston Harbor without displaying a flag of origin. In other words, they were sort of basically trying to sneak in. The Harriet Lane fired a shot over their bow to tell them they couldn't do that, and this was, in fact, the first naval shot of the Civil War. Hmm. World War I, six Coast Guard cars were sent to help convoy duty. There was a lot of trouble with U-boats in World War I, and so they were escorting convoys from Great Britain to Gibraltar. And in the course of this, and unfortunately near the end of the war, a U-boat sank the Coast Guard cutter Tampa with a loss of all hands, 1918. This is a picture of the current Coast Guard cutter Tampa in memory of those that were lost. The name lives on, and remember the color of this ship. World War I, Lieutenant Eaton. Lieutenant Eaton actually had Alaska duty. He was on the Coast Guard cutter Bear for 2 years, but then decided to go and was selected for the first Coast Guard Naval Aviation class in 1917. The Coast Guard had decided that aviation was going to be important early on in naval aviation. They went to aviation training is held, and this is a picture of the first class with Lieutenant Eaton just to the right of the propeller. World War II, this slide says, the Marines salute the Coast Guard for their big part in the invasion of Guam. They World War II, Douglas Monroe. On Guadalcanal, Marines were being driven into the ocean, about 500 Marines. Volunteers were requested, and Douglas Monroe, who was a signalman first class in the Coast Guard, volunteered to take a small squadron of boats to rescue these Marines that were being driven into the sea. They made multiple trips, and on the last trip, there was the last group of Marines that were being rescued, one boat, and they were going to be right in the line in a direct line of fire. So Douglas Monroe, the people, they were saved. He was killed. He's the only Coastie that's ever received the Medal of Honor. And in honor of his actions, this is the Coast Guard Monroe stationed in Korea. Also in World War II in Ketchikan, this is the Coast Guard cutter Cyan. I've actually had the pleasure of knowing Cyan. It was stationed at Ketchikan. It had actually done a couple of years of Alaska duty before the war started, was refitted, and then stationed at Ketchikan. It did anti-submarine patrols, convoy escorts, which convoys were going to Adak and Kodiak and et cetera, and also search and rescue duty. Okay, moving along. So that was basically some basic Coast Guard history. Now for Alaska. Alaska purchased in 1867. I'm sure you've all seen this picture before of William Henry Seward. Right away after the Alaska was purchased in March, so not too long after that, the revenue cutter Lincoln arrived in Sitka carrying a survey by George Davidson, visited Kodiak and Unalaska. Now, after when Alaska was purchased, the general feeling, I think, in the Congress and maybe the public was, what, $7 million to buy a frozen wasteland? So the Cutter Lincoln, they actually, in part of the survey party, they ended up with 300 pages of report, which was used to help for the very first appropriation for monies for the development of Alaska. And a little bit later is the purchase ceremony. The Coast Guard Cutter Lincoln also brought the official delegation that received Alaska from Russia for this ceremony. When we purchased Alaska, the only thing we actually got, as far as I can tell, is Baranof's Castle in Sitka, which was the capital of Alaska. On top of Baranof's Castle, there was a beacon, a light beacon, and this was basically what we inherited for, as near as I can tell, for infrastructure. So there was a separate lighthouse service at the time. It was not at that time part of the Coast Guard. The lighthouse service took a look at this and said, that is so far away and so hard to maintain, we're not going to have anything to do with it. It's done as far as we're concerned. So the Army, out of the goodness of their hearts, actually ran the beacon on top of Baranof's Castle for 10 years. And as far as I can tell, they were just doing it for free. This is the revenue cutter Wayanda. The Wayanda did another basically survey and research in Alaska, and they recommended that a Federal Reserve be established to protect the northern fur seals and Aleut people in the Pribilofs. After the research they'd done, they had seen the there, and they needed some protection. So this was acted on quickly by the feds. Then they also surveyed Cook Inlet and some of southeast Alaska. Now, near the Aleutians, remember, when Alaska was purchased, it was considered to be a frozen wasteland, including, like, everything, and so which included fishing. But the Wayanda went down and did some fishing near the Aleutians and found that there was rich fishing grounds for cod and halibut. In 1877, the Army, which had been basically, I don't want to say occupying, but I'll say protecting Alaska for 10 years, from 1867 to 1877, all of a sudden, they were pulled out. And when I was first doing the lookups on all this history, I just had this as a point in time. But the more I looked at it, the more confused I got. I said, gee, that's odd. They're here. They're actually, they're the force in Alaska, the federal force in Alaska, and all of a sudden, one day, they're gone. Well, just a little bit of background. The year before, the Battle of the Little Bighorn, 1876, huge black eye for the Army. And then the coming that year, 1876 in November, Grant is don't know how he looked on the Little Bighorn, but it was still a huge black eye. And so the two candidates were Samuel Tilden, who was a Democrat, and Rutherford B. Hayes. Election happens. Tilden wins the vote, gets 184 electoral votes. 185 are needed to be president. 20 votes were not actually cast, I think, by mostly southern states, which we couldn't do the same way today, but 20 votes were not cast, and Tilden had the and one electoral vote short. So they basically set up a commission to deal with this, the Congress did, and there was a lot of backroom dealing in the Congress, and when it was all said and done, this was during Reconstruction. So after the Civil War, we had Army troops essentially occupying some southern states. Some governors weren't allowed to take their seats. But as part of the deal to solve the presidential election, it was agreed that all federal troops would be withdrawn from the South, and the governors were allowed to retake their seats. And for that deal, Hayes picked up the rest of the electoral votes. So when the Electoral College, when it was counted, Hayes had 185, and Tilden had 184. Rutherford B. Hayes became president. So we didn't just invent exciting elections here anytime recently. So that year, 1877, the troops were all withdrawn by June. Well, the president had stated that the War Department was no longer going to be in charge of Alaska, but the Treasury Department was. And under the Treasury Department, the Revenue Cutter Service. And so the Treasury Department then becomes responsible for Alaska. And also, was at the end of this, the part of this deal with this whole thing in Congress about withdrawing the troops, the Act was in 1878. And basically what that, and then taught us is an old British common law thing, and that's where we used to, in the West, that's where we used to form, the sheriffs were allowed to form posses that came from this British common law thing. But the Posse Comitatus Act was the military, the army, is not allowed to enforce any civil laws anywhere in the country. And I'll get back to that in a little bit. This is the core one. This is the Coast Guard, I'm sorry, the Revenue Cutter. I do this interchangeably sometimes accidentally. It all kind of blends in my mind. Revenue Cutter Corwin was actually a Secretary of Treasury under Millet Fillmore. It made its first Bering Sea trip in 1877. In 1880, Treasury Secretary Sherman ordered annual Bering Sea patrol duty. And Treasury Secretary Sherman, who later we sort of know his name today because that's his name on the Sherman Antitrust Act, and his brother was William Tecumseh Sherman. It's kind of a famous name, but he's the one that ordered the annual Bering Sea duty. So that whole thing of Alaska going to the Treasury Department really changed the future of Alaska quite a bit, probably. The captain of the Corwin, as it went around Alaska, The captain of the Corwin was Captain C.L. Hooper. He visited several villages around the state, and one of those villages turned out to be, it was renamed later to Hooper Bay. So it was named after Captain Hooper. And then Captain Michael Healy took over the Corwin in 1883. In 1884, early aids to navigation. So remember, the only aid to navigation we had to start with was the beacon on top of Baranoff's Castle. Then finally, in 1884, 14 iron buoys were set near Sitka. And then in 1895, so when the Army pulled out of Sitka, the beacon on top of the castle was also out. So finally, in 1895, a beacon was added back to Sitka. In 1897, the only aids to navigation or around Sitka. So this is the Klondike Gold Rush, and as you all know, Southeast Alaska is a treacherous place, especially without any kind of help with aids and navigation. So the Klondike Gold Rush actually happened with no other help except close to Sitka.
Representative Rush.
Thank you. Through the chair, we've heard the term revenue cutter twice or read it, seen it on the screen. What is a revenue cutter?
Well, going back to Alexander Hamilton, he's the one that he's the one that basically said we need a system of cutters. So a cutter was a reference to a smaller sailing vessel with two masts, and that's what the original revenue cutters were. The name revenue cutter stuck until the Coast Guard in 1915. But the revenue cutters were there to assist in the aid of collecting revenues for the country originally.
They were. Okay, thank you.
Okay, the early aids and navigation. I think I, 14, oh, sorry, the 1884, 14 iron buoys were set near Sitka, and then 1895, the beacon light was finally added back to Sitka, and then the Klondike Gold Rush. And then in 1885, the revenue was transferred to Alaska. It served 41 years on Alaska duty. The longest serving revenue cutter / Coast Guard cutter, that number's never been surpassed. It's a pretty famous ship. Captain Mike took command of the Bear the next year in 1886. He, in fact, was the first first African-American to receive a commission in the United States. He was also the first African-American to a ship, a commissioned ship. Now, he was African-American, but he was actually, his dad was a slave owner, and it's kind of a whole story by itself, but he was able to go to school and get into the Ribbon and Cutter Service and do very well. And the fact that he was African-American was basically a secret. He never told anybody, and it was never known for a long time.
If I may, the United States Revenue Cutter Bear used to be displayed in the lounge. And then when they redid the art in the lounge, I grabbed that. It's in my office now.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, it's arguably...
That's the rules, Jerry.
It's arguably the most famous revenue cutter ever. Then the revenue cutter bear... So the bear controlled illegal liquor distribution used by traders to exploit natives. And so the native people referred to the bear as, I'll butcher this, Omiak Pectectonica, or the fire canoe with no whiskey. In 1888, some whaling ships got, this was summertime, some whaling ships got stranded in the Arctic up near Barrow, and they were stuck. They couldn't get out. And Captain Healy was told that that was a near impossible rescue, but he went ahead and went anyway. This is his name, Helroen, Captain Helroen, Mike Healy. The cutter bear in 1891, this is a sample. I'm just going to read a short sample of what the revenue cutters were all doing at the time. The revenue cutters were very important in Alaska. And I'm just going to read a short thing of some of the activities that were going on. On Healy's 1891 cruise, the bear secured witnesses for a murder case, ferried reindeer from Siberia to Alaska, transported the territorial governor on a tour of Alaska's islands, shipped a USGS survey team to Mount St. Elias, carried lumber and supplies for school construction in remote locations and the Arctic, delivered teachers to their remote assignments, carried mail for the U.S. Postal Service, enforced seal hunting laws in the Pribilofs, assisted the Coast and Geodetic Survey Team, provided medical relief to native populations, served all life-saving and rescue missions, and enforced federal law. So that's a sample of what the revenue doing for Alaska in the early days.
Question, Rivers and Rumble.
I just want to say that's just so impressive. I mean, one, you know, that they were able to save lives, you know, without a single life lost, and now that this, that's called efficient government right there.
Yes, and almost all the ships I've referenced so far were doing a lot of these same things. And it doesn't include what hasn't been included is the judicial function. Sometimes the revenue cutters and later the Coast Guard cutters were referred to as the floating court system, because they would bring the judge or judges and the legal function to remote Alaska, which, you know, we didn't early on. I mean, Alaska wasn't even a territory until 1912, so we didn't have those judicial districts and things that came along later. So the Revenue Cutter Service at port played an important role. Reindeer. So before I get into reindeer, I've actually gotten in trouble in the past. I understand, but once in a while, somebody thinks reindeer and caribou are the same. Just for the record, reindeer and caribou, although technically the same, caribou are wild animals indigenous to North America. Reindeer are not. Reindeer are domestic animals that were domesticated in Europe and brought to North America, which is what this slide is about. Early on, Captain Healy realized that after the white people came, the natives had been relying on hunting and fishing. Well, the stocks of everything were being depleted after the white men came. And so malnutrition and starvation was happening in the native population. So Captain Healy basically put his head together with Sheldon Jackson, and they decided that, and they wondered if reindeer might not be the solution as a domestic animal. So they, in 1891, the bear shipped live reindeer to the Aleutian Islands from Siberia just to see if they could actually survive the transport first and then prove that they could actually survive in Alaska. They could. So in 1892, he brought over the first official shipment of animals to Alaska. During the 1890s, Cutter's transported thousands of reindeer, and by 1930, domesticated reindeer herds totaled 600,000, with 13,000 native Alaskans relying on them for subsistence. To commemorate Captain Healy, this is the Coast Guard Cutter. It's a little hard to see, but it's red, so it's an icebreaker, so remember the color of this ship. And in 2012, as all of you may recall, Nome was having a terrible time. They were basically running out of fuel. An arrangement was made to get a Russian tanker into Nome to refuel the city, and in order to facilitate that, the Healy actually broke ice for the tanker to get in and out. And also, in honor of Black History Month, this is Alex Haley. This is a picture of Alex Haley. He is, in fact, in a Coast Guard uniform. He's a famous author, wrote the book Roots, famous TV miniseries. He was the first journalist in the U.S. Coast Guard. He was the first African-American to make chief in the Coast Guard. He actually retired with 20 years in Coast Guard service. And to commemorate his name, this is the Coast Guard cutter, Alex Kodiak. This slide, now we're going to go back to the bear for a moment. In 1887, again, whalers have gotten in trouble in the Arctic. These whalers got stuck in the ice not too far from where the other groups got stuck in the ice. The only difference is this is now wintertime. So there were 8 whaling ships. President McKinley ordered a rescue of the whalers that were stuck there. So this is the first time before climate change that a ship sailed into the Arctic during winter. And they sailed as far north as they could go, which was, I never actually have, somewhere around Nome. They were definitely south of Kotzebue. And the plan was that they obviously couldn't take a ship up there, but the plan was to rescue these whalers with reindeer because they were going to starve to death. And so the captain sent Lieutenant Jarvis and Ellsworth Berthoff to drive a herd of reindeer all the way around coastal Alaska to Barrow, which is about 1,500 miles. So in March 1898, and this is a whole story by itself. I mean, they stopped and gathered reindeer along the way and drove them across Kotzebue Sound and the ice, and it's a whole story by itself. But they drove reindeer 1,500 miles, and they finally ended up delivering 382 reindeer to the stranded whalers with no loss of life. And to commemorate the Revenue and Coast Guard Cutter Bear, this is the modern-day bear, which just actually recently turned 35 years old. And one of the people that were, one of the two people that the captain sent was Ellsworth Berthoff, and he had his own long story, but he ended up being the first commandant of the Coast Guard when the Coast Guard became a military service in 1915. To commemorate Ellsworth Berthoff, here's the Coast Guard cutter Berthoff. When I was working here as a staffer in 2010, of actually being able to tour the Berthoff on an open house here, it was really very interesting, modern ship.
Representative Sather.
Thank you, Mr. White. Through the chair, I'm seeing some, there's been some similarities of the historical schooners you described here, but as we look at the modern ships, the Berghoff looks like the sharkiest of them all. How many different classes of cutters are there currently being used in the Coast Guard?
Wow. The Coast Guard does so many things. I don't know if I can really answer that question properly. This particular ship is a patrol craft. It's the newest of the, this is called the security class, and I kind of like your description of sharkiest. This is a security class, and you know, the first one was actually commissioned in 2010, and they're still, I think there's a total of like, I forget, there's like 12 or 16 of these are going to be commissioned. But they're the newest, largest patrol craft the Coast Guard has. As far as how many different classes, that goes scaled down all the way to small boats in the Coast Guard. It's kind of a complex function, but we go to buoy tenders and icebreakers and... So I'm probably not really able to answer that question as I should.
Then maybe a more useful one. If this is the newest security class, what's the oldest cutter in service still? What does that date to? What class is that?
Let's see. The oldest class in service for the patrol craft, it's probably the 378s, which I showed you a picture of one of a little bit ago, which was the Coast Guard Cutter Monroe based in Kodiak. Those are 378s. They were built starting in the late 60s, I believe, and some are still going today. They're slowly going out of commission, but I think that's the oldest class. Certainly for patrol craft, it is. In 1898, the Revenue Cutter Manning started Alaska duty and started Bering Sea duty in 1900. Well, in 1912, the Manning was tied up in Kodiak, Alaska, which turned out to be a pretty famous day, this one particular day, because that was the day that Katmai erupted on the Alaska Peninsula, the biggest volcanic eruption in the 20th century. Some villages were destroyed, even though I don't think too many, a lot of people didn't get killed. They'd had warnings and so they were evacuated, but some communities were actually destroyed and a huge amount of ash was dumped on Kodiak. This picture is of the Manning, I think still tied up in Kodiak. Most of the residents in Kodiak actually got on the Manning. They got underway the next day and went out to sea for a time, and another small boat, so they completely evacuated Kodiak and then came back after the volcano kind of calmed down. But the Manning then helped actually relocate several of those villages, transporting the people and some of the products and things, because there were several native villages that were destroyed during the eruption. And that's about, on the previous slide, we saw the Manning. I don't know how long. It's not that big a ship, but about 500 people were actually on board when they evacuated the whole town. Okay, next slide is lighthouses. So 16 lighthouses were built originally, beginning in 1902. 11 are still using today. If you've ever taken the ferry to Haines, the lighthouse on the lower left is Eldred Rock, and so you've probably seen this lighthouse on the way. Unimak at the bottom of the Alaska Peninsula and the start of the Aleutian Chain, so it's not technically the first pass, it's actually this. The False Pass is really technically the first pass, but Unimak. So if you're going from the North Pacific into the Bering Sea, the Unimak way to get there. A lot of marine traffic goes through there. And here it is right here down near the bottom. Well, in Unimak Pass, a lighthouse was built first in 1903, then it was rebuilt in 1940. So the lighthouse you see here on the left, this is the rebuilt lighthouse, and I think it's when it was brand new. It's a concrete structure. It's probably about 50 feet off the water. In 1946, there was a really bad earthquake near the Aleutians. A tsunami came and wiped this lighthouse completely off the island. And what you see here on the right is what's left of the lighthouse. It's completely gone. There were several Coasties that were killed. The head lighthouse keeper at the time, his name was Anthony. To commemorate his name, this is the Coast Guard cutter Anthony Pettit, It's stationed in southeast Alaska, and it's one that maintains aids and navigation. So remember the color of this ship. There'll be a short quiz later. During World War II, in Unimak Pass, and during World War II, the War Department decided that they were going to turn down rates of navigation in order not to help the enemy navigate around Alaska. Well, unfortunately, it also didn't, you know, not only did it not help the enemy, but it didn't help our friends, because this is the SS McKinley, which had run aground in bad weather near Scotch Cap Lighthouse in 1942 with no light. The light wasn't lit.
Real quick, Representative Rauscher.
Thank you very much, Chairman Tuck. Could you just go back a slide?
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure.
Mine's in black and white.
Oh, yours is in black and white. Oh, yeah, sorry. Sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry about that. Well, see, and that worked out well in black and white.
Yeah,
because it's
quick enough.
Yeah. Okay, this is the going back to aids and navigation. So remember, after the Klondike Gold Rush, which was 1897 essentially, so in June 1906, finally the first real aid to navigation is actually installed. And it says here it was black numbered. It was a buoy, a number 2, established at 45 feet of water down near Funter Bay. So this is when we finally started actually getting some real aids to navigation in the state, and not counting the lighthouses, which were the large aids. And by the way, the Lighthouse Service was a separate organization until 1939. So the lighthouses were, until 1939, that was a separate agency. And then in 1939, it was actually merged with the Coast Guard. But the Coast Guard was doing all the rest of these aids of navigation. This is the Coast Guard cutter Storrs. It was stationed in Kodiak for a long time. It had a very interesting service. It's a whole story by itself. A friend of mine here in Juneau, Damon Stubner, he did a wonderful documentary on the Storrs and its history. But I'll just give you just a little bit here. In World War II, it had a very interesting history, but it wasn't in Alaska. It was actually in Greenland. Very interesting story there. Then in 1948, it was transferred to Alaska for Bering Sea duty. And then in its role in Alaska, it also did the same thing that its predecessor had been doing. So it was delivering medical, dental, and judicial services around the state. It survived until it was actually stationed in Kodiak when it was decommissioned until 2007. It was the first ship to circumnavigate North America in 1957. And along with two other buoy tenders, they actually went all the way around and ended up in the East Coast. The Coast Guard and bridges. So some of you may recognize one or both of these bridges. On the left, that's the old Juneau Douglas Bridge, which was eventually taken down. On the right is a new Juneau Douglas Bridge. So, kind of a little known fact, the Coast Guard actually approves all bridges that are over navigable waters of the United States. So there's a section here in Juneau, there's one charge of actually approving bridges if they're over navigable waters. The Coast Guard today, I try to keep up. I'm not really an expert on everything the Coast Guard does, and I'd actually... Representative Sponholz and I had a brief discussion before the meeting, and I'd suggested that maybe a good thing to do would be actually get a review of the current Coast Guard, from the Coast Guard, about what they're doing in Alaska. It'd probably be a good thing to do for the committee. Anyway, just briefly, sort of close to being accurate, there's 14 cutters stationed around the state, 17 aircraft and two air stations, one in Kodiak, one in Sitka. There's three small boat stations and many other things that the Coast Guard does today. One of the things that they have continued to do is aids to navigation. So this picture I took last summer in Anchorage. So if you've ever been down to Point Warren's off at the Anchorage Airport, you may have seen this aid to navigation. This actually is an after range marker in long ship channels. sometimes they put up range markers, and there's a forward and after range marker, and one's low and one's high, and when they're lined up, that means you're in the channel. Well, this is the after range marker that's just below the runway at Anchorage International. And I was fortunate last summer when I took this picture that a moose actually was photobombed my picture. The Coast Guard made
part of the aid to navigation.
Not very dependable, but the Coast Guard maintains about 1,300 aids of navigation around the state. Some of them are seasonal, like right here in Juneau, Gastineau Channel. There's seasonal markers that go into Gastineau Channel during the summertime, and then in the wintertime they have to take them up. But Gastineau Channel is a very tricky place. It's getting shallower and shallower, and so they do their best to keep it as safe as possible. Okay, just in a little bit of kind of review, the Coast Guard's the only branch not in the Defense Department. So originally started on the Treasury Department under Alexander Hamilton. It stayed in Treasury until 1967 when it was actually moved to the Transportation Department. And that's when the Coast Guard got the responsibility of approving bridges. Then in 2002, after 9/11, the Coast Guard was moved to the Homeland Security Department, where it resides today. The only branch of the military to allowed to enforce civil law, which I spoke of before under the Posse Comitatus Act. You don't really want the military enforcing civil law, but you definitely want the Coast Guard enforcing all maritime laws. And the Coast Guard is the only branch, as stated first, not the Defense Department, which is good news and bad news because the Coast Guard's always competing with other civilian functions, like Homeland Security, for example. But before, it was a Transportation Department. So the Coast Guard used to compete with freeways for money. And now it's competing for, you know, with everything else under the Homeland Security budget. And last year, August 25th, the Coast Guard Cutter Maple, also a buoy tender, Representative Rauscher, this is also black. It's stationed in southeast Alaska. It also, in of the 60th anniversary, it circumnavigated North America and went all the way around to the East Coast, came back through the Panama Canal on its way back to Alaska. The Coast Guard flag. When you see military flags displayed, as one of the five branches of the services, you'll always see the Coast Guard flag on the right. When they're displayed in this order, it's always on the right, and it's white. The Army is the other white flag on the left.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, through the chair. Thank you, Chairman Tuck. Is there a significance behind the colors and when they were adopted as far as the blue stripe and the red and the white one?
I don't really know the real history behind the development of the flag. And I hesitate to answer because I don't want to say anything wrong about that. I'll have to look that up. But I think it was actually developed not too long, probably after right after the Coast Guard became an official part of the military.
Well, thank you very much.
Representative Reinbold.
And I'm going to piggyback on that question, and I'm going to give you a pop quiz. So what do the banners mean? That's in the banners of the flag, and what does the Semper Paratus mean?
Okay, the banners. Okay, so of course, on top of the eagle, E Pluribus Unum, which is our national motto, if you will. The Semper Paratus is actually Latin, so I'll diverge for a moment. The phrase that the Marine Corps uses is Semper Fidelis, which literally is always faithful. So in the Coast Guard, Semper Paratus means always ready. And as far as the, I really don't know about the rest of the flag. I'll definitely have to look this up.
It looks like it resembles the symbol, U.S. seal, United States.
Yeah, the eagle, of course. It's the eagle.
And even with the arrows and the branch.
The olive branch.
Yeah.
And the 13 colonies and the stars.
Right.
Representative Sadler.
I
was just going to offer that. That is the national crest. Bee Pluribus Unum is our national motto out of Benin 1, Semper Paratus, out of Always Ready. Also heard it called Semper Gumby, which means always flexible.
Semper Gumby?
Yes. Gumbus, the Gumby Gumby, Gumbus Gumby.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Oh, well, through the chair, thank you, Representative Sadler. I've never heard that one before. this is the Coast Guard emblem. So before 1967, when it was moved to the Treasury Department, the ships did not have this stripe that you see today. That was actually started in 1967. Before that, if you looked at a Coast Guard ship, they were white, and the only way you could really tell it was a Coast Guard ship because it had the letter W before the hull number. After 1967, all Coast Guard ships and boats got the racing stripe, which many other countries have copied, and you know, they try to emulate the U.S. Coast Guard, but. Okay, so these are the three ship colors that I've shown you. The top left, that is the maple. It's black. It's a buoy tender. It's what, when I was in the Coast Guard, it's what we called a working ship. All Coast Guard ships are working ships, but we sort of meant hard work blue collar ships because they're the ones that maintain the aids of navigation. So it's extremely hard work. They pull buoys out of the water. They've been sitting there for a year or years. They're completely covered with barnacles. They have to refurbish them, make sure that everything's in working order, then they put them back. And then all the aids of navigation, you see the floating aids, the buoys, and then the fixed aids you see on the shore, the day markers and stuff, the Coast Guard maintains all of those, and it's a huge amount of work. The ship on the right, that's the Berthof. We talked about it briefly earlier. That's the newest of the security class colors, cutters. And, of course, the bottom, that actually is the Healy. They're red, so all Coast Guard icebreakers in today's world are red. Okay, this is the... I cut this article out of the Anchorage paper in 1999. this is the Polar Sea, taken from the boat launch in Anchorage. It visited Anchorage. It was an open house. I didn't go on it at the time. I'm not sure why, but anyway, I didn't go on it at the time. So this is the Polar Sea. There were two of these ships built in 1976 when they were commissioned. This is the other one. This is its sister ship, the Polar Star. Well, on the previous slide, I showed you the and it's essentially being used for parts for the Polar Star. The Coast Guard I think they still claim this as an icebreaker, but the heavy functional icebreaker that the service has at this time. They were built in 1976. This is getting to be an aging ship. Every time they take it out, something happens. They support the U.S. Interests in the Antarctic every winter, or their summer, our winter. This is a huge issue. The Coast Guard of the United States needs icebreakers. There's money. There's actually another icebreaker has been approved. There's not really any money to build it right now. We're hoping there was money put in the budget last year that never made it through the Senate. There's money being put in again this year's budget, which we'll find out in March if any of it survives. Hopefully we can get enough money to start building one more icebreaker. We really need 5 or 10 more icebreakers, but right now we're sort of struggling. And it takes about an icebreaker. Unfortunately, they're expensive. They cost about $1 billion, and it takes about 10 years to build. So there's a lot of lag time involved here.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. And I guess what my question is, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I know Russia has a ton of these. How did this get off of our radar with such a large, you know, coastline and such a critical importance? To me, this is beyond me how this happened.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. This has been coming on for, I mean, these were built in the 70s. This is over 40 years old. This has been coming on for decades. And I'm not sure. You know, I mean, this is no one Congress. This is no one anything. We just need to have a national priority to get icebreakers out there, because as the climate changes, this is going to be more and more important. I can't even stress this enough. So hopefully, this year, I think there's actually money in the budget. It's like $750 million. Remember, that's not even enough to build a whole icebreaker, but at least it's, you know, I think they could get most of it done. If it'll pay the budget, I think they could actually get started on it. So hopefully this year in the Congress, they have the foresight to actually pass this. But, and as to how it fell off the radar, I honestly don't know. I mean, I've been sort of tracking this personally for probably 15 years, trying to, you know, I've understood. I mean, once when I was working here at Juneau as a staffer, the Coast Guard did an update downtown somewhere, and I went to this thing, and the Admiral was speaking, and I asked the, this was some years back, and I asked the Admiral, I said, well, what's the plan for icebreakers? And this was probably maybe in 2010 or 2011 or something. And he said, you know, he sort of told me more or less off the record that, well, there is no plan. I mean, we had no plan to really go after this, but it's hugely important for national interest and for our state interest. I mean, I think the Coast Guard has played such an important role in the past, and the icebreakers are sort of part of its future, of this important role to carry on as, you know, more oil exploration, more cruise ship passengers, more freight.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. This is probably politically incorrect, but I don't really care. But the amount that we spend on health and social services is about $3.3 billion. We could build three icebreakers.
Well, that's nothing compared to the military budget. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in the military budget. So, to me, this ought to be part of the – I mean, the Coast Guard's not in the Defense Department. And in all fairness, the money that's been – I think the money that's proposed now is actually in the Navy budget, which is sort of where it belongs. Because one thing I didn't mention, in time of war, the Coast Guard actually becomes, and declared war. In a declared war, the Coast Guard becomes part of the Navy anyway. So, but there's this money, so it'll be interesting to see if this passes this year or not, any of this money.
And I think you meant $100 billion.
I'm sorry, did I say million?
Yeah.
Oh, I might have well said cents.
Mr. White, I think the federal government has authorized money for icebreakers, but has not appropriated the money, which is an important distinction that we should all of us remember. So it's easy to signal your intention and desire to have something happen should the money appear. It's something entirely altogether different to actually make the money appear.
And there is a resolution that's going to be going through Arctic Policy Committee addressing that.
I think our strategy is to pray for global warming to accelerate.
Well, through the chair, Representative Sadler, even with global warming, I mean, the thing about global warming is what it's going to do is it's going to allow us to have more time in the Arctic. But in the winter time, we're still going to have ice. We're still going to need icebreakers for, you know, the hundreds of years. And so, this is still a huge issue. Okay, so that I'll just throw. I got a couple other things. This. I don't know if I should have put this in or not, but this is what it looks like going in the Coast Guard 1969. This is a boot camp.
You guys, those eyebrows.
This is my ship. I was on a patrol ship, and starting in 1970, we did ocean stations, long patrols in the Atlantic under major air traffic routes in the middle of the Atlantic. I put this picture in just to show you that how much fun the ocean can be at any given moment. This is a historical plaque that was we did it about 3 years ago, commemorating my ship. That was our home port right there in downtown Pensacola. On the interest of time, burden to bear, I'm gonna pass this slide because it's not actually directly Coast Guard. This is my. We get a lot of friendly ribbing from the Navy as Coasties, and this is sort of my friendly ribbing back. At the top is a $4 billion, basically prototype Navy ship, and it actually broke down or something. And at the bottom, the captain says, hang on, we're coming to, you know, help rescue you. When I did the research on this, I sort of started kind of a year ago. I was using the Coast Guard website, and then basically at the end of September, the website, all everything I'd been going to on the Coast Guard website, I ran into this. This is some defense department to keep everything safe, so it was kind of personally not fun for me because everything I've been looking up was no longer available. So a lot of the references I have for the slides I use are actually, I can't access them anymore. So that concludes my presentation.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I really appreciate the historical lesson, Mr. White. My question to you is, do other nations, other maritime nations, obviously have the same coastal protection and revenue interests as the United States does. Do other nations employ the same model of having a separate naval warfare branch and versus revenue cutters and so forth, or is do they incorporate that into their naval functions?
Gosh, and I know, I only know a little piece of this. And interestingly enough, I was talking to former Representative Harris, John Harris, yesterday, and his great uncle was a Coast Guard captain who helped develop, after World War II in Japan, he actually was like the captain of the port in Tokyo or something like that, and he helped develop, the initial Japanese Coast Guard. And all I can really speak to is Canada, which I sort of know a little bit about. Canada also has a Coast Guard, which we work closely with on many issues. I mean, we do search and rescue and joint things together. But the difference with Canada is Canada has a discrete Coast Guard that does a lot of what we do. But in Canada, it's not a military force. It's a civilian force. And so as far as the military function, I don't think they have, as far as I know, they don't have any role in that.
Yes.
And could you describe to the extent of your knowledge the grade and rank structure of the Coast Guard versus the Navy or the Army?
The grade and rank? Yes. The Coast Guard mirrors the Navy. In fact, up until 1967, our uniforms were identical except for one small thing to the Navy. So the ranks in the Coast Guard are all the same as the Navy. So you have, you know, JG and et cetera. And I'm sorry, what was the other part of your question?
The enlisted ranks.
And the enlisted ranks mirror the Navy. So the Coast Guard mirrors the Navy ranks in all aspects and grades E1, E2, et cetera. Enlisted in officer ranks. I got out. I made it to E5 in my 4 years in the Coast Guard.
And are the retirement benefits the similar or the same for Coast Guard versus Navy?
Through the chair, yes. The retirement benefits are the same. All the military uses the same scale for pay and for retirement and everything, and for veterans benefits and TRICARE, their medical service. It's all the same as the whole rest of the military.
Can you indulge me one more?
Yes,
I know
please.
That combat branches have CIVs in combat. Is there a accommodation or medal or recognition for a Coast Guardsman who comes under fire?
Is there, I think they get the same, so like in Vietnam, they get the same medals, and the Coast Guard's eligible, for, as far as I know, for all the same medals that any military service is. And like I said, the Coast Guard's always been in all the wars, so as far as I know, it's eligible for all the same medals. It's just a regular military service with a peculiarity of not being in the Defense Department.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher.
Oh, yes, thanks, Chair. I just want to thank you for your presentation, your dedication to the Coast Guard, and your fondness for history, and we appreciate your presentation. Thank you for your time.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Representative.
Yeah, and I would like to thank you as well. Thank you for your service, first of all, but thank you for being such a good advocate for armed forces, even in your retired life, and in sharing the history that you've looked up and all the research that you've done. It's very much appreciated. Well, yes, Representative.
I'm going to give the gentleman a chance to pitch. So the Army has West Point, Navy has Annapolis. What is the officer's
Okay, the Academy. Okay, thank you for bringing that up, Representative. The Coast Guard also has an academy, and it's just like the other military academies with one difference. In every other military academy, you have to be appointed by a senator or someone. In the Coast Guard Academy, the only requirement to get in the academy is to apply. So you don't have to have an appointment to get in the Coast Guard Academy. But other than that, the academy is in New London, Connecticut, and it is, it's just like all the other military academies with, I think, all the same military fun.
For lack thereof. Thank you.
And when's the next time you'll be delivering this presentation?
I have one more scheduled at the moment. I was vacationing in Hawaii with my wife, and I got a email from the Admiral, the District Commander here in Juneau, requesting that I come present this to him, because I had presented this to the Coast Guard Auxiliary in Anchorage, and he got somebody told him, and then he asked that I do this for the Admiral and some of his staff. That's tomorrow.
All right. Is that open to the public?
No, I don't think so. Building. We're going to get an escort. Fortunately, my wife's able to go with me, but we're going to get an escort up to the Admiral's lair, I think it's his media staff that are coming along. So.
Good. Well, thank you very much. Sure. Thanks again, Dean White. Appreciate that.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Time is now 2:14, and we'll adjourn the Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs.